evening as Marilyn Kate has joined.
Morning.
Very good. Marilyn, hello. You're very welcome.
Or evening or afternoon.
Right, we so far have 11 participants, such as myself, Philip. We have Alexander from the GA. We have Carrie Karp. We have Ellen. We have Glenn. We have Grant. We have Jay Scott. We have Marilyn. We have Philip Renault.
Mr. Gregory Ruth is joining.
Mr. Carrie Karp is joining also.
We have Philip Carbonzi. We have, just joining us, Richard Dindle, Thomas Rossler. And we have Tony Holmes. That's 14 altogether, which I think is probably close to who we were expecting.
Philip, did you get Greg just sung in? Did you get him?
Greg, yep. That's noted.
Excuse me, Elizabeth Portinov is joining.
Thank you.
Hello, good morning, everybody.
Hello.
Elizabeth, hello.
Elizabeth.
Bonjour. How are you? Hello.
Hi.
So we might just seem to double check on the list. Am I missing somebody? That was Alan who's with us. Okay.
How many people do you have on the call, Philippe?
We have 15 on the call, and that includes 2 from the secretariat and 2 from the GA, Thomas and Alex. Of those who we're also expecting, we have nobody from the non-commercials so far. And I believe both. Nothing to say to the contrary from Eric or Chun. Bruce is due, and Ken, I think, are both due to be with us. We don't have them yet.
Excuse me? Mr. Bruce Tonkin is joining conference?
Indeed, that's answers one. Bruce, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Philip.
I think probably we can make a start. So I think from my records of who had said they may be joining late or not at all, we just have possibly Eric and Chun still to join, and Ken, and otherwise everybody else I think said they would be here is currently here.
Tony Harris will also join later.
Tony, I thought was actually on, but that's my mistake.
Tony Holmes.
All right. Yeah, Tony, so indeed, Tony said yourself, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Thanks, sorry for that. So we can make a start. I had sent out, as you saw, a proposed agenda, really just a list of the topics that we had previously identified, and suggested that perhaps today we could pass over some of those areas quite quickly to see if there are Ken, you're very welcome, to see if there are areas where we have broad common agreement. And then perhaps to identify those areas where there may be differences of opinion. And there was also a request to talk just at the beginning of this in terms of the conclusions that I attempted to draw from our first discussion and how they should best be described. So let's just start on that and hopefully not spend too long. As you saw, based on the discussions and the minutes, I had tried to sort of extract what I thought had been broad points of consensus or suggestions that come out so we could actually make something concrete from what we do each time given the very short timeline we have. And there's been some discussion on those, and those of you who had been looking at your email today would have seen some refinements of the wording there. The substance hadn't changed substantially, but various members of this group had proposed some better wording, which I was very happy to adopt in that draft. Comments on the process or the content of that itself?
This is Bruce Tonkin.
Bruce? Anybody else want to talk on this while I just make my first list?
Probably Marilyn.
Marilyn, okay.
10 Stubbs, Philip, please.
10. Anybody else? Okay, we can come back. Bruce.
I just had a comment on the last sentence where you say the Mames Council felt that the greatest danger of mission creep lay in the areas of security and consumer protection. I just wanted to be clear that we weren't saying that there was no role for consumer protection, just that it's an issue that, you know, it shouldn't grow much beyond what it has.
I think yes, there is a role for consumer protection. That was the intent of my wording, yes.
Yes, okay.
Okay. Marilyn. Marilyn?
I think Bruce may have captured, actually, I think it's the use of the terms felt the greatest danger of mission creep, but that, I took out of our discussion that we wanted to have a clear sense of boundary, but that we understood that there was an interplay between, let me just use security as an example. The limited space where ICANN does have some responsibility, such as ensuring the integrity, reliability, and security of the root servers, even if they don't operate them, and ensuring that the next layer down, where they have contracts, that they have some need to have some standards there, but not to go beyond that, but that there's an interplay between that narrow space where they do have responsibility and the rest of the interdependency of the Internet. And I think I'm just sort of concerned about the use of the phrase the greatest danger of mission creep, both in and Bruce captured my thought about consumer protection. Not, I don't have suggested wording for you. I just wanted to note that.
Okay. Carrie, I'd like to speak too.
Sure, okay, you're on the list. Perhaps we're talking about the word potential or whatever would be clearer than danger, which is suggesting something that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the key thing there, Philip, is the way it reads just as a statement on its own is as though that security and consumer protection are mission creep.
Right.
Okay. Areas of additional security and additional consumer protection. Would that capture it?
It's really that, I think what Marilyn was saying is capturing the fact that we're not trying to cover the security in the entire Internet or consumer protection.
Okay, but there was a bit of both of those which we are currently covering, which we're comfortable with.
Yeah, which is under the functions of names and numbers, yeah.
Okay, well, let me take that point, and I'll see if I can think of some better wording when we send out the next version of that plus the notes of today. Ken, you're next on the list.
Yeah, well, as far as wordsmanship goes, I'd have to agree with both Bruce and Marilyn. I try to avoid in a document like this staying away from words like danger and so forth. I think it sends the wrong message. That wasn't really what I was going to comment on, and I'm going to make one real quick comment with regards to this process that we're taking because I'm starting to become a little concerned.
Mr. Eric Idiase has joined the conference.
Thank you. Erica, welcome. Ken, continue. But,
yeah, I would apologize if I'm being redundant in something that you've already said, Philip, but I think at some point in time, very soon, we're going to have to start taking a look at these documents and at the information that we've received from ICANN so far. And we're going to have to stratify it in terms of what we can be most effective in addressing and recognize the fact that if we want to, we can spend the next 6 weeks talking about what ICANN should do and what they shouldn't do, and yet we will not come up with any constructive suggestions as to how they should approach doing it. And that's something that's of serious concerns over. We've got serious potential financial issues to deal with ICANN. We've got structure of the board in the future moving forward. We've got a whole bunch of issues that I think that they're looking for constructive suggestions on.
Right. Ken, do you have, I had listed those things you're talking about as six separate items. in order 1 to 6. Do you have a suggestion for changing that order in terms of getting to priority?
I just want to try to get us on at some point in time down the road into those specific areas.
Okay.
I'd hate to spend 2 hours talking about whether or not I can, should, you know, just problems like the root server when you know as well as I do it. For the last 2 years, we've had process problems that need to get addressed as well, you know, as well as the financing aspect.
I think we get broad agreement to that. Carrie, you're next on the list.
I'd like to start by apologizing if I do any. I'm recovering territory that was trodden upon when I was not around last time out. But I'm actually responding to the phraseology that Marilyn used, that it's unrealistic for ICANN to claim the task of ensuring anything over which it does not have operative control. And ICANN can ensure the stable or any other operation of any servers that it can't pull the plug on or push the button to start. So I think a whopping part of the problem that we've got here is to take a look at the problem with the ccTLDs. ICANN is mandated to do something that ICANN is not a priori empowered to do, and ICANN has to figure out how to acquire that ability, and problems arise. So I actually note that the very outset, the initial quote, ICANN is responsible for coordinating the Internet's naming. And that's what's up. The Internet's naming is by design distributed among countless organizations. And how can ICANN even identify those organizations, much less coordinate their activity? So there's something too broadly sweeping about all of this for my taste, and I'm not really sure we're going to be able to do anything implementable as a result of it.
Philip, can I get back in queue?
Yes, ma'am. So, Carrie, are you saying that you defer from the sort of conclusion that we were saying in recommendation one, that ICANN's function should not be extended beyond what is outlined in this note that I referred to from
what I'm suggesting is that note itself may require some focus. And what we might want to have somewhere in our own commentary on the scope of message. Indeed, in broad terms we do agree with this. However, we regard as plausible the potential benefit to be gained from further focusing that description or whatever.
No. Okay, yeah, answer that, Marion.
I think I want to speak very briefly on this, and then I would like to actually respond to Ken's suggestion. Which
I'm hoping, Marion, we can very rapidly finish this topic and get on to item one, funding.
Okay. I need to better understand what Carrie's concern is, and because we struggled with this, believe me, and many of us who are here on this call were a part of this whole discussion over the years that led up to the launch of ICANN. And in the Internet, we all know that we live in largely live in a best efforts world that continues to evolve toward more certainty in terms of the technical coordination, interoperability, and other infrastructure issues. And that has worked very well, and the coordination has worked very well. I'm reluctant to be real definitive about language because of the potential of missing a critical function. At the same time, I'm reluctant to be real prescriptive at this point in our discussion.
Okay. Thank you for that. Other other comments on this, or can we move on to item one of today's agenda?
Philip, this is Jay Scott.
Yes, Scott.
The only thing that I would like noted in the recommendations is, as I pointed out in my comments, with regard to the specific listing of items, the 1 through 5, I believe it is, and then there are several subpoints under 5.
Yep.
I believe that it is somewhere we need to say that we all realize that that is a non-exclusive list,
mm-hmm.
that as the Internet evolves and matures, will change. So some of those things will no longer be part of ICANN's responsibility, and there will be other things that will be part of ICANN's responsibility.
Sure, we're capturing it at one moment in time, but things
are
changing.
That's right. Yeah. And I just think it needs to be clear, because a lot of what you hear from the stakeholders is when ICANN notices a new problem and begins to realize that it's something that it now needs to take under its umbrella and begin to handle, because it has become something that's affecting the development of the Internet. People complain, well, it's not on this enumerated list that you said that's all you do.
Mr. Cochetti is joining conference.
And so I just think it's clear that if we recognize that the Internet, what the Internet is, by the very fact that it is a malleable thing, that so is so are the duties.
Sure. I think what you're saying, perhaps, is a broader restatement of what Carrie was saying in terms of there may be need for change that could be a greater focus on some areas, and you're spending more broadly in terms of evolution that there may indeed be new areas to add.
I think it will do both. I think at times it could shrink, and at times it could grow. Yeah. It really depends, and I think those are moments in time.
Yeah.
I think one year it may be bigger, and the next year smaller. It just depends on what happens.
Let me try to capture that thought in the next iteration.
So, it's Carolyn, but I think we should ask Carrie. I agree with the formulations Jason Scott just made, but I actually thought that Carrie might have been asking. And so, Carrie, I need to ask you this. You might have been asking about making it definitively narrower. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I was. I think that this whole thing is a tad too diffuse for us to be certain that we can make this converge upon what everybody would agree is a productive solution.
I just thought, Philip, it was important to understand that.
Sure. What I'm trying to say is I don't think Carrie's point and Jay Scott's are mutually exclusive. I think they're... the facets of the same uncertainty.
I'm sorry, Philip, this is Roger. Could you just tell me where we are in the discussion?
Yes, we're just concluding discussion on the notes that are done on the first call we had, and we were just adding a couple of thoughts that would feature in a future iteration of that.
Thank you.
And so if we may, let's move on to the substantive issues of today, and start with funding. What I had suggested on the agenda was perhaps we may wish to briefly talk about short-term funding, because we've been made aware that there is an immediate funding crisis facing ICANN, and then perhaps talk about any longer-term options for that funding. So just on short term, is there any perhaps information that anybody would like to give first before we get on to opinion?
I can make a short report of what I've found out, and then other people maybe might want to edit it if I'm not current.
Okay, well, why don't you go ahead, and then I'll take a list of reactions after you said that. Go ahead.
Okay. There's been a series of public outreach meetings in the U.S. by the Department of Commerce, and several of us from the U.S. have participated on those calls. So the current understanding that I have is up into night before last, the RIRs were declining still to pay the $1.4 million that they owe for 1999, 2000, and 2001. And because of that, ICANN and other people, such as the CCPLDs, are in different stages of paying as well. Because of that, ICANN is in a significant shortfall and actually did not have operating capital to carry them through beyond 2 or 3 months. But night before last, the RIRs did agree, although they are not signing an agreement with ICANN at this point, they did agree to pay 50% of the $1.4 million, and that provides some financial relief to the financial situation.
Okay, that's good to hear. Who would like to comment also about short-term funding, if I can?
Yeah, Ken Stubbs.
Ken, anybody else?
Jay Scott.
And Jay Scott. Anybody else?
I have a comment too, Roger.
Roger. Ken, let's start with Ken.
First of all, I wanted to ratify what Marilyn said. It's my understanding this is the same situation. I have a concern about short-term funding, and it's the classic case that I've seen with nonprofits in the past, and that is that there are a significant amount of, I won't use the word distractions, but the task list for the current ICANN staff and board is quite full with all of the various issues. And one of the biggest problems I've seen in the past with nonprofits and other organizations is operational staff have to take time away from actually their day-to-day operational duties to go out and try to raise money. It's such a terrible distraction. So I think we need to keep in mind that we need to try to create a scenario that gives ICANN the capacity to address the issues that are before it right now and to give the staff the opportunity to avoid these kind of distractions. And I'm hoping that other members of the council would agree with me. Anybody who's been involved in these kind of businesses knows what I mean.
Sure. Ken, thank you. Jay Scott.
I just think that, you know, one of the points that needs to come out at this point, and I don't mean to insult anyone or bother anyone, but our own house is not in order with regard to financial responsibility to ICANN. There are several groups that are a member of this council that are years in arrearages, and on many times the council itself has voted in a way that makes it easier for these parties to stay in arrearages. Such as my understanding that parties that get current for 1 year are still allowed to participate in the process, even though they may be several years in arrearages back. And I think it's very hard for us as a names council to come out and suggest that others participate by paying the funding that they need to pay when, in fact, our own house is not in order, and that is something that needs to be addressed.
Jay Scott, thank you for that sanguine reminder.
Can I get in queue?
Marilyn, you're in queue. Roger, you're next.
Roger's next, right.
Two points I wanted to make. One is that if you look at the short-term ICANN financial condition, I think what you'll find is that there has been a shortfall of income for the past 2 years, including this year and the past year, that was based almost entirely on a shortfall of receipts from numbering registries and CCTLDs below those that were budgeted. The receipts from registries and registrars have been almost 100% of what was budgeted. The shortfall, the failure to receive funds from CCTLDs and numbered registries in each case is almost entirely related to the contract negotiations between the two sides, so that we, you know, there simply should be no confusion over the fact that the short-term budget condition of ICANN is, to whatever extent it is below what is expected to be, completely a function of the contract negotiations that have been taking.
All right, Roger, can I stop you for a moment? Could I ask the noisy typist to please mute their telephone? Thank you, Roger. Do continue.
The second, and I think the evidence of that was that in the case of the numbering registries, obviously they took the full amount that they were going to pay to ICANN and put it into an escrow. In the case of the CCTLDs, they made in probably a total of about $900,000 worth of what they described as donations in response to about $1.3 million worth of what ICANN viewed as sort of dues, or the equivalent of dues. So that's my first point. My second point is that... In in looking at the larger picture, one piece of the ICANN short-term funding condition that's rarely discussed, and I think should at least be kept in mind, is that outside of the main source of revenue for ICANN, which is invoices to registries and registrars, and its attempt to invoice number and registries and CCPLDs, there's a third category which is substantial and could continue to be substantial even in the short term, not to say the long term, and that is what I would loosely describe as other sources of funds. This ranges all the way from application fees for new CCTLDs to solicitations for donations to charitable contributions to whole wide range of things. And this has been and could be an important part of any larger picture of ICANN's financial condition. So, just a couple of factual points.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Marilyn, you're next in queue.
I actually just wanted to ask, what outcome are we trying to achieve in this part of the discussion? To come up with suggestions for how to address the short-term financial situation that can contribute to stability? Because my own sense would be that is the purpose of what we should be thinking about, and if there's anything that the Names Council or the constituencies can do to contribute to the kind of funding that categories that Roger was suggesting. So, for instance, it seems to me to be very important, regardless of what the individual constituencies' long-term interest is in what ICANN looks like in the future, important to stabilize them in the short term so that that can be worked through. And that would be the purpose of our looking at the short-term funding and asking if there is anything that can be done to stabilize that funding so that they're not continually distracted, as Ken said, and really unable to do the day-to-day policy and administrative work. Along that lines, it may be, and I make a big distinction, J. Scott, between the funding that the constituencies make to the self-funding of the Names Council and larger funding issues of ICANN overall, because we are in a separate budget category. What I'd like to do is focus on the larger budget issue, and then we can come back maybe to how we fund ourselves. What I'd like to focus on is there anything else that we think can be done to stabilize ICANN funding in the short term that the Names Council can contribute to?
Okay, let me just before anybody tries to answer that, let's just try to think where we are at the moment. Are we saying that in broad terms we would wish to encourage all those who currently owe ICANN money to pay, and in that regard we welcome this recent response from the IIRs? Would that be an appropriate conclusion
Bruce,
at the moment?
If I can just add to the queue.
Okay,
yeah,
Bruce.
I have a comment on an answer to your question too, Philip.
Fine, Bruce and Roger. Anybody else on that question? Not for the moment. Bruce, go ahead.
I think the comment I would make from a budgeting, I mean, you used the term O. Now, O generally implies that you've had some sort of contractual relationship and someone's provided a service to you, and you're paying for that service being provided. The issue I think ICANN has is it's sort of saying from the top, we believe that we are providing a service to you, and this in particular the RIRs and CCTLDs, therefore you must pay. And the other party is basically disagreeing with that and saying, well, no, we don't actually think you are providing that service to us. We don't have a contract with you. We don't owe you anything at the moment.
Right, so this is a fundamental difference between an expectation that ICANN has in terms of its budgeting,
yes,
and the expectation that the other parties have in terms of funding.
Yeah, and so therefore in its budgeting process, it should be really budgeting its core functions based on revenue that it can earn contractually in terms of its core functions. And then some of these additional functions that it might wish to get into that require additional funding, then that, you know, those functions are conditional on receiving that funding. And so it really comes down to some of the comments I think we're making in some of the in the last call, but it's really a matter, I think, in your first recommendation. But ICANN really needs to divide itself into suitable functions and budget for those functions accordingly. And some of those budgets are more certain than others. And where the budget is not certain, then that function that just doesn't get performed.
Okay, that's an interesting development from where we had been. So we may be something like extorting, in general, sound budgeting based on certainty, and in line with our recommendation to encourage budgeting based on function.
And I think in some of those areas, and I agree with Roger, that I think ICANN does have the ability to raise revenue, for example, running the ICANN meetings. But most other organisations I know, like the IETF, they charge about $500 or $600 to participate in the meeting. And given the general cost of people travelling there, that's actually a trivial cost for those attending, for the majority. But it's significant in terms of covering the cost of that event.
Okay, so some alternatives may indeed be meeting fees, which I think have been raised in a number of areas before, which I think ICANN traditionally has only avoided in terms of its sort of public interest, public participation role, but there may well
but
be.
But that's fine if you've got revenue, but they're sort of saying, well, we think we've got a revenue of $1 million from a party that's not intending to pay us.
Yeah.
And then we're saying, and on the other side, we're going to let people attend the meeting for free.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Could I add something to that?
Yes, I had Tony, and was that Elizabeth as well?
Yes, I got online and put me on queue. Yes, thank you.
All right, okay. So I've got Roger, Tony, and Elizabeth in the list. Anybody else? No? Then Roger, go ahead.
Philip, in response to your question, I'd agree completely with the previous comments that in the case of the funding, of the shortfall in receipts from the numbering registries and the shortfall in receipts from the CCTLDs, it seems to me it would be completely inappropriate for the council to sort of express a view of the details of the contract negotiations between ICANN and these parties, especially since this is an ASO issue in one case. And I think what is appropriate is for us to encourage the parties to reach agreement, and once agreements are reached, then I think the long term funding issues would be resolved, and some of the short term funding questions would be resolved too. But I don't. It seems hard to me how the council could try to inject itself in these contract negotiations.
Yep.
We don't know all the details, and so we should encourage people to make progress.
Okay. No, I think a conclusion in terms of encouraging parties to reach agreement would be something that we could certainly agree to. Tony.
Yes, just to pick up on the point Bruce made regarding the possibility of adding meeting fees. In the ISPs, we actually had some discussion way back with both members of the ICANN staff and also with Vince over this, and I will add that it wasn't something that they were against at that time. I think there were problems recognised as to how it could be introduced, and the approach we were basically proposing at that time was to include the possibility that it wasn't compulsory. In other words, if people came along and didn't want to pay the fee, they wouldn't be excluded. But if you came from perhaps a large company or an organisation, then it would be appropriate to pay that fee without actually having it endorsed. And I think under the terms of the reform, that's probably one proposal we should actually now promote and put forward once again.
Okay, yeah, sounds sensible. Elizabeth.
Thank you, Philip. Let me add one clarification with what was said and well said by several people before. Roger Coschetti was speaking about shortfall from IP registry and CCTLD. It is correct, and it is the outcome of 3 years lasting situation with ICANN, which is not listening to CCTLD, and which is considering ICANN staff and ICANN board probably, that we have been discussing mainly with ICANN staff, is considering that they provide the same services for CCTLD as for GTLD, whereas this is completely not true. So it is one of reasons, and one party is being estimating that CCTLD shall contribute to the cost on the same basis as GTLD without getting any services, so it leads to the deadlock. I've been listening with to what Bruce was saying, that separate functions, to separate ICANN functions, the one for which they can get money because they provide service, from another one which needs to be worked out, and to figure out how to proceed. It is probably the way to go with CCTLD, at least.
Okay. Thank you for that endorsement there. Some of our thoughts are already straying into perhaps the area of long-term funding with some of our the latter suggestions there. So why don't we open up discussion then to encompass long-term funding as well. And on that topic, who would like to be on the speech?
Philip?
Long-term funding. Yep, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, Bruce, who else? Nobody else at the moment? On long-term funding. Nope. And Elizabeth, go ahead.
I have just a question. What for clarification, what do you consider long-term funding?
All right. What I had done in... because I was made aware of an immediate funding crisis for ICANN, I had captured that by short term, and long term means any plan for the stable ongoing funding of ICANN.
Okay, so stable ongoing funding for ICANN or for various ICANN functions, whatever structure we are going to have, is actually the matter of discussion.
Yes.
I just wanted to point out that the ICANN has been publishing during the last weekend the budget proposal for 2002 and 2003, a comment from CCTLD, no one of our comments has been taken into account. The budget, the ICANN budget for 2002 and 2003
yes.
has been published on the website.
Uh-huh.
This budget is making several assumptions and do not take into account any input from CCTLD. So it is just continuing on the former 3 years.
All right. So the assumptions in the budget as to the stream of funds from the CCs are still the same set of assumptions that you saw in the past.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Philip, I'd like to get in queue on that.
Interesting information. Manon, you're in queue. Bruce, you're next.
Thank you, Philip. The registrars held a teleconference yesterday to talk about a number of the issues coming out of the reform proposal, and one of the areas of discussion was on the budget, both, I guess, the current budget for the next financial year as well as longer term. I think just to sort of give a perspective from the registrars, the majority on that call seemed to be in favour of paying a larger amount to ICANN in return for better service.
And what do you mean by better service?
We just find that everything is incredibly slow to resolve any issues. We don't feel that ICANN has really managed its contracts with the registrars and registrars.
Oh, okay. So again, this is part of what we had said last time, where this is something where we're not talking about any additional services, but merely performing what we expect of them more efficiently.
Yes, I think
the
overall perception was that ICANN was under-resourced in terms of the staffing in the areas that concerned registrars.
Can I put me in the queue, would you, Philip, please?
Sure. Can you in the queue? Okay, so what you're saying is that perhaps we've actually been asking too much of ICANN, and more money would help them do that we have asked of them better.
And that comes down to the comment I made earlier, that it needs to be quarantined into function. So, I mean, if the registrars contribute another 30%. We wouldn't want that spent in areas that had nothing to do with us.
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting point. Okay, then Marianne, you're next.
Let me go after Ken.
Okay, Ken, go ahead.
Thank you, Marilyn. First of all, I'd like to echo what Bruce was talking about. I think what we have is a circumstance where funds that are being directed through fees assessed to the registrars and the registries are being being used in areas to help develop outreach and so forth for ICANN, but to some extent I think, and I could speak for the registrars as well, and that is that ICANN is significantly under-resourced in terms of manpower to deal with a lot of the issues that pop up. And I think that in talking to the significant number of registrars, they are willing to see an increase in an amount that where they recognize that some of that increase would be applied towards helping to deal with issues that they have on a day-to-day basis. I think
right.
If you look at the budget, you'll see that there are positions that are proposed as well as positions that are still not yet filled. And I was not at all uncomfortable with their proposal for staffing. I don't think that there's any issues in there that from my standpoint would bother me, and I don't think that most of the registrars would be.
Right. But are you saying that the registrar's desire to give more money is subject to, if you like, ring fencing some of that additional money for specific services?
Well, I think what the registrars are, it may be the fact that, and I unfortunately couldn't make the call that Bruce was talking about, but I've had other discussions. I think what they're really saying is that there are specific contractual mandates in the relationships between the registrars, the registries, and ICANN that are not necessarily being addressed at this point in time because ICANN doesn't have adequate resources. So what
right.
we're saying is if we're going to help provide these additional resources to ICANN, we'd like to see them keep the commitments that they made to dealing with these contractual responsibilities and relationships.
Okay. And was there any discussion, or perhaps Bruce, you could answer this, if registrars are going to happy to give more money, is the amount of money such that registrars would need to increase prices to their customers in order to cover that, or is it small enough that you will be able to take that from existing revenues?
That wasn't part of the discussion.
Okay. Marilyn, then you're next.
I think what I would do, I just wanted to reference for everyone, and it was read into the public record while we were in Accra. One of the BC members, Ron Andra, had floated a proposal indicating that business users should be willing to, if necessary, pay more in their registration fee so that there could be additional funding flowing through the registry collection process to ICANN so that they could improve their functioning. And people would like for me to, Ron has a one-page summary of what he said, and I can post it to the list. It's just a personal statement, but it I think could be useful for the group if there's interest in my posting it.
No, before, yeah, please go ahead and visit. So other comments on...
Now, can I put me back in the queue for one more comment, please?
Yeah. Ken, you're back in the queue. Anybody else like to be in the queue? No? Then Ken, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to suggest that you take a look at the Schedule 1 of the proposed ICANN budget for next year. Philip, I'm trying to deal with your question on materiality, okay? In other words, if we're talking about putting in additional funds, how much is material and what are we talking about? According to the Schedule 1 of the budget here, let's not worry about, how do I put it politely, even a million names is not material. According to the schedule there, there are approximately 15 million Tier 3 CCTLD domains and approximately 33 million GTLD domains as of March 1st, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we're looking at 48 million names. Okay? As you take the total ICANN budget, which is, I'm not going to even scroll up, but let's assume it's $6-7 million. So let's suppose it's $10 million, okay? We're talking about less than a quarter a name.
Yep.
All right. So if, let's say at this point in time, we're talking about a fee of, let's say, 10 to 12 cents a name or 12 to 15 cents a name. We're talking about a dime a name, 10 cents a name. We're not talking about a dollar a name or $3 a name. Let's put this in its real context and materiality.
Right, and I think that was also one of the conclusions that was made by what Mauden was saying at the meeting in Ghana, in that the total amount the users would have to contribute to make a substantial difference to the ICANN budget indeed was not that significant in terms of the total cost of acquiring a name. Okay, where were we? That was an interesting set. I think Ellen, was that right?
Yes, I'd like to just ask a question.
No, Ellen, sorry, I'm just checking a list at the moment to understand who wants to speak. So, Ellen.
Myself.
Elizabeth.
And Marilyn again for a point of clarification.
And Marilyn to clarify. Okay, Ken, so did you want to finish off there?
No, basically all I was trying to do was set this in a context. We're not talking about a significant marginal increase in any specific individual.
Sure. Okay. Ellen, please go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question, kind of a point for clarification. Assuming it is only 10 cents or another quarter a name added on for individual users, which makes it sound, you know, so de minimis as a joke, would you be then expecting the registrars to just tack that on or forward that and absorb the extra 10 cents or the country, you know, the CCTLDs to be doing that?
Because
you start adding up those de minimis amounts, unless you're going to bill everybody for it, it seems to me that there may be some objections to people actually, you know, putting forth that money.
Well, let's put it this way. At the I can't speak for the registrars. From that standpoint, because as Bruce indicated, it wasn't discussed. But from a practical standpoint, I think that there are methodologies for dealing with it, and I see price adjustments. The market tends to deal with issues like that. I doubt very much if you're an IP lawyer for, let's say, Fortune Brands or Procter & Gamble, and you're going to see your registrar increase your annual cost by 10 cents from a practical standpoint. At the same point in time, registrars are spending a significant amount of resources right now in dealing with issues that, frankly, if I can't have the resources, adequate resources to deal with, they wouldn't necessarily be spending. And the ICANN process right now forces both registries and registrars to expend significant resources in dealing with issues that possibly ICANN could be dealing with more effectively if it had the resources. So to a great extent, there may be cost savings already in there if ICANN was capable of being more efficient because it had adequate resources to deal with this. So.
Okay, that's a very interesting point indeed. If we can,
and Bruce Tonkin, if you can add me to the queue.
Sure. If we can increase overall efficiency, indeed, there may be costs that we can actually remove from the system, and of course that clearly benefits everybody. In the queue next was Elizabeth.
Thank you, Philip, very much. I would really warn you to not consider CCTLD and GTLD at the same level and with the same approach. And putting together, you say it in English, cat and dogs, I believe, is not a correct way of doing. From CCTLD perspective, we at each CCTLD level, almost each CCTLD level, we have to deal with local ICANN ourselves. We have our registrars or ISPs. We have registry functions. We have to discuss legal matters on national level. We have to take care about all this issue completely outside of ICANN. And anything assuming that it may be just proportional to the number of domain names is completely wrong. You cannot go this way. So it is just warned to you, it is not a correct approach to put together CCTLD names and GTLD names. It is not done the same way. It is not operating within the same framework.
Right, because the services you get are different, and any potential cost saving of that you get from a more efficient ICANN is going to have less impact on an individual CCTLD than it would on a GTLD. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There is a lot of things which are done within ICANN which don't have any impact on CCTLD. And it is actually this dual approach of the world we are observing on the Internet. On the one side, we have this global village, and it is what ICANN is about, is managing the global village. But on the other side, there is the village which is built up from 200-something countries and territories, or 190 sovereign countries, if you take only sovereign into account. And the life is going on within borders.
Well, this is Richard Tindall. Can I jump in on that?
On that particular point. You mean...
Can I make a few words?
Do you want to talk generally, or do you want to talk on that specific point from Elizabeth?
Specific point from Elizabeth.
Then go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to endorse fully what Elizabeth said, and but also draw a distinction, as we have in the past, between two types of CCTLDs, those that operate in the sort of environment that Elizabeth just described, and those that operate in an almost completely... open commercial way globally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, another important distinction. Marilyn, you were next on the list. Marilyn, are you with us?
Hello?
Marilyn, yes, we can hear you now.
Sorry. I just wanted to provide a bit of clarification to Ellen's... question, which I think might be a little bit responsive. We have studied this proposal that Ron raised somewhat within the DC, Ellen, and the point of view that we've heard back from our members goes something like this. Right now, registrants pay anywhere from $0 to $6 to $8 to $14 to $35 or some other number for the registration process, because in the competitive environment there's a range of options presented to them. Out of that amount, some amount of money is already being passed to ICANN by the registrant registry. The idea that there would be a whole new administrative process needed, I think, is not really... the situation, but that our view was that this should be worked out within the existing processes that the registrars registries have, and that the increases include a small not to exceed administrative fee, so that the registrar or registry themselves is not having to subsidize that, and that really in the grand scheme of things, I don't see there being a significant increase to registrants on a per-name basis.
May I speak? Get in queue, Phil.
I just wanted to clarify for clarification. If you're saying that it's already there and it's just a question of reshuffling somehow the money, but the registrars and registries aren't going to absorb it, then where is it getting reshuffled from?
I'm saying that the fee does come from the registrant, Ellen, and from the view of the BC, we are, after all, the registrant, you know, we do have IT counsel and IFTs, et cetera, but really the registrant, and we don't speak for all of them by any means, really the registrant is already paying whatever fee is being paid to ICANN. So I don't think it is just a question of reshuffling. It is a question of some increase as well.
May I just clarify then? If we set aside for a moment Ken's suggestion that there may actually be real cost to take out of the system by simply making ICANN more efficient, and we look slightly sort of in the longer run where indeed all the money starts off in the hands of users, in the hands of the registrant, what is the main difference between the model that you're suggesting and an existing way that's been done, given that the mechanism of transfer is the same?
Let me just comment on the registrars themselves are the people who are in the best position to think about whether there are other efficiencies, benefits that would be gained, and that therefore they might want to make a contribution out of some other source of revenue. I am not making a comment on that. I make the registrant role. My comment about the registrant role is that the business constituency at this point we haven't heard any negative feedback within the constituency, and it looks like we are going to be in a position to support even an increase in a registrant fee if that's what's necessary to stabilize ICANN's funding. The other point I would make, because I think it's responsive to a point that Elizabeth raised, in our statement so far, we actually distinguish between the CCTLDs and the GTLDs, because in our view and our experience in registering in CCTLDs, we do think they get different kinds of services, or maybe different, or I don't want to use the word less, but more distinct kinds of services, both now and in the future from ICANN, and have other kinds of obligations like RFC 1591. So we do distinguish between the two in our present draft statement and say that the majority should come from the GTLD registrants supported through the process of the registrar or registry aggregating, taking an immense small administrative fee and passing through. We're not looking for the registry and registrar to subsidize this, but we think they're key to the process. And I think the difference might be that users would be acknowledging that they need to be the stable source of funding to ICANN.
Okay.
Ken, would you put me in the queue, please, Ken?
Ken, you're in the queue. Bruce, you're next. Bruce, in your introduction, could you just say for 2 minutes how the existing funding happens, if you like, in terms of the way that there is that the basis for funding in terms of contractual or volume or names or whatever, just so we have clarity on that, to be useful.
In terms of a registrar, there's a formula, and it has a fixed and a variable component. So there's I don't know the exact numbers, but just the concept is that there is a fixed component, and then there's a component that's related to the volume of names that you register.
So the fixed component is fixed. It's a fixed sum for every registrar, regardless of size.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And the
basis for that obviously is so that you balance things out between big and small registrars.
Yeah.
So you have a choice if you make it entirely variable, which means that a registrar that registers one name pays 10 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And then that means that the cost of servicing that one registrar is actually much higher than 10 cents. So you need obviously a fixed cost in there.
Yep.
And then the variable components to deal with size changes. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. And now go ahead and make the point you're in the queue for.
I guess I just wonder whether we're discussing something that's even relevant for us to be talking about. I thought we're talking about mechanisms of funding ICANN, whereas we now seem to be talking about pricing. And one, the reason why registrars would not be talking about pricing on a call is legally we can't. We're a group of people that compete against each other. We can't talk about fixing some sort of price or agreeing amongst ourselves how much we raise or decrease prices. But that's just the first point. So that's one reason why I wouldn't even comment on that. But just to go back into...
Hello.
Hello.
Bruce, we just lost you, I think. Hmm? I see your microphone's gone grey as well on my screen, so that means you're perhaps muted. I'm going to take Jay Scott down. We'll come back to you, Bruce, when you rejoin us. Jay Scott. Jay Scott, are you with us?
Sounds like we've lost part of the call.
Indeed. Glenn, could you talk to Carla and see what may be happening with our call? Let's just have a voice call of who can hear me at the moment. I'll take participants as I know them. Alexander.
Yes.
Bruce. Carrie.
Yes.
Elizabeth.
Yes.
Ellen.
Yes.
Eric. Glenn.
Yes.
Grant.
Hello.
Gregory.
Yes.
Jay Scott.
Yes.
Ken.
Yes.
Marilyn. Philip. Carpenter.
On the call.
Yeah. Richard.
Yes.
Roger.
Yes.
Thomas.
Yes.
Tommy. Tony.
Yes.
Okay, I think most are there. We just seem to lost Bruce and Jay Scott, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm sorry, I'd stepped away.
Okay, Jay Scott, you're now in queue temporarily until Bruce returns. Carry on.
It seems to me that the problem becomes I will say that the intellectual property community, at least in my discussions, is very much in favor of the model that Marilyn has talked about where... Hello?
It's Peter DeBlanc joining. I guess I'm an hour late.
Peter, you are an hour late, but you're very welcome all the same. Glenn, could you try and find out what that ringing tone is and
get
it? Thanks.
Bruce Tonkin, I'm back on the call.
Bruce, great. We're just taking Joe Scott, so if we ever finish up with him and I'll return to you.
And so we're very in favor of the model whereby the registrant, which is many of our constituents, pay some sort of, even if it requires an increase in fee, of a de minimis amount that when aggregated would support the ICANN financially. But to Ellen's point, and what I hear from some others on the call, is there becomes a conceptual problem. I, as the user, pay a fee to the registrar. Now, what I hear from the registrars and registries is then once that money is paid to them, that's their money. And all the money that they pay to ICANN is their money. So I hear people saying, well, we collect this money, and we pay it to ICANN, it should only be targeted to services that are provided for us. And so it seems to me that's where Ellen's question comes in. Well, it may only be 15 cents per registrant, but when you add it together, it's millions of dollars. And so what I hear is the people who collect this money and pay it over to ICANN, they conceptually believe that that's their money. It's not registrant money. It's registrar-registry money. And that registrar-registry money is they pay all the funding, they're the big funders, and everybody else isn't paying their weight, and it should only be then targeted to those functions that serve them because they're paying the bills. And so it seems to me that we have a conceptual problem here because my registrants believe that they pay the money. They certainly sign the check to all the registrars whenever they have their credit cards debited for $35 to $70 or whatever, depending on what form they choose. So it seems to me that Marilyn's idea works. You know, you come to the registrant, you say, do you want to pay an extra 15 cents to ICANN? And they all raise their hands and they say yes. We then pass the money on and it gets aggregated. Then comes Ellen's question. Now we have 22.5 million names that VeriSign has to add 15 cents times and they have to pay this check. Well, when VeriSign pays the check, they say that's VeriSign's money. It's registry money.
Despite those who claim... So who was going to incur?
Philip, could you put me in queue, please? Thomas here.
Thomas, who else in queue?
I put Roger in the queue.
Roger, okay.
I'm Bruce, Philip.
Was that Ken again?
Yeah.
Ken, you're already in the queue.
I know, I was just reminding you.
just in response to what Joe Scott was saying, I guess the... to some extent, the trick that needs to be achieved for the user fee concept to work is how that's handled in the contractual relationships. Because at the moment, the contractual relationships are with registries and registrars, as far as ICANN is concerned, and not directly with users, because those are the bodies are the intermediaries, and how that is decided upon is probably the key to it. The administration then becomes relatively clear. Anyway, just with their thoughts, Ken is next in the list.
Can Bruce talk and come back on?
I beg your pardon. Actually, yes, sorry, Bruce.
I'll yield right now to Bruce, but I would like to come in after he gets done.
That's fine. Yeah. No, Bruce was due to be with us.
I want to respond to what Jay Scott said and then also something Elizabeth commented on.
Okay. Bruce, go ahead.
Yeah, I just sort of wanted to get back onto the issue of pricing. It does relate to what some others have been saying. But let's just say the way the system works at the moment is that the registries get charged a fee and the registrars get charged a fee. Now, if you increase the fee that the registry is charged, they have the option to increase their registry price. If they choose to increase their registry price, they need to get approval from ICANN to do that, and that's usually based on, you know, demonstrating costs and so on. So that's at the registry end. At the registrar end, there's no price controls. If we have an increased cost, it's purely up to the individual registrar to decide whether or not they wish to pass that on to the customers in terms of price, and that might vary depending on whether they think they get a cost saving or not. So it's crazy to talk about price at the level of the registrars, because that's a completely competitive market. The only area you can talk about price is at the level of the registry, because that is a regulated price, and the ICANN needs to approve a change in price or an increase in the maximum price for registering a name. To get to the point of whether it's the registrar paying or whether it's the registry or registrar, so to use a couple of analogies, if you look at government taxation in a number of countries, and certainly in Australia and I think in most of the United States, there is a equivalent of a value-added tax, and that's clear to the consumer. So they know that they're paying 10% of whatever it is of the price of the goods, and they know that that money is going to the government. And in that role, the supplier is basically acting in the mode of tax collector. The other model is in other industries, if we take telecommunications, telecommunications carriers in most countries, certainly in Australia, pay various fees to the government in terms of license fees, which in turn funds the regulatory function. I don't think end users think of themselves as paying those license fees. Those end users think of themselves as paying for a service from their telecommunications supplier, and those licensing fees, etc., are treated as a cost by that supplier. That's the current environment we operate in. If you want to change the environment, I'm not even sure whether we can legally do that, and I think others may know the history, but you're basically then saying that ICANN imposes a tax directly on registrants at 10% or 1% or whatever it is of the price.
Philip, I'd like to get in queue.
Okay, Bruce and Mario, you're in queue. Ken, you were next.
Yeah, and actually Bruce is kind of leading into what I was going to comment on. I appreciate J. Scott's comments because I think they have a significant amount of relevance, and there is a tendency throughout the entire process for posturing with regard to support for ICANN. But I'd like to remind those of us who've been around for quite a period of time, recall at one point in time where there was an attempt to surcharge registrations, which created a firestorm in oversight committees of the U.S. government, the idea that that a tax could even be considered really wasn't worth all of the controversy it created. I do also want to remind everyone, though, that if you took that logic, you would assume then that the registries and registrars would have a much greater say on the board. But yet, I think you find that in the case of ICANN's board, that there is a balance amongst those people who are members of the various constituencies. If you took the proportionate percentage that the registries and the registrars, quote, would like to take credit for, you would have then assumed that they would have a proportionately significant higher representation on the board. At this point in time, I believe there are no registry representatives on the ICANN board, and there is one registrar constituency member, Amadeo Abril. So I guess from that standpoint, it doesn't necessarily fall true. One comment I had with respect to what Elizabeth was talking about before, with the nature of the CCTLDs and the fact that you're dealing with individual communities, I'd like to follow up on what Richard Kindle commented on, and that is that there are certain CCTLDs, and I would use the Spanish and the French CCTLDs as good examples, where the nature of the restrictions on registration tend to create a second level or a third level domain that is very, very closely tied to the national identity and use of that specific name. There are other CCTLDs where the general nature of both the restrictions and the use of the second and third level identifiers bear no significant association at all to any national use or identity. And I think that's where, once the CCTLDs are willing to deal with that differential and stratify themselves, it would probably be easier to deal with. But I just, that was a response. I don't really want to go there. Or,
mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
It's an interesting question. Thomas, you're next on the list.
Several points. First of all, concerning the CCTLD, GTLD distinction, I'd like to ask you, Philip, to just add it as a work item to the summary of today, that at some point in the future, criteria must be elaborated which CCTLDs, should be considered, so to speak, CCTLDs proper, such as, for instance, the French one, and which ones should be considered GTLDs in disguise, fee-wise. Now, I have got a question to, I think it was Bruce Tonkin, who explained the current fee structure for registrars. I seem to recall that you said we have a fixed component, one per registrar, plus a component which depends on the number of registrants. What kind of dependency is this? Is it linear? Bruce?
Look, I can't recall. I mean, it's in the agreement, so I can get back to people perhaps post a response on that. I'd rather not give an inaccurate.
Okay, but as I understood, it was proportionate to the number of names by some measure.
Philip, point of clarification here. I'm okay. Sorry to interrupt, but if we do have an ICANN staff member on the call, I'm not sure whether Louis's monitoring the call or not. Louis may be able to answer that question very quickly.
All right. Louis's not on the call, I'm afraid.
All right.
But anyway, carry on, Thomas.
Because if this variable amount depends in a linear way, which means we have a fixed amount of money, which is due in terms of fee per registration, then we basically have some kind of per registrant fee. It is, of course, up to the registrars if they believe that it is good for competitive reason to sponsor this fee for their registrants, but they are just as free to pass on this cost to registrants as part of their price. For this reason, I believe that indeed the concept suggested that registrars or possibly registries should be used as a channel to move registrant money into ICANN is a good idea. I also believe that there is indeed a way to identify which part of the money they are deducing, they are moving to ICANN, is, so to speak, user fee and which is registrar fee, because I somehow doubt that the amount of work ICANN has to do with respect to registrar or registry is really proportional to the number of registrations with that registrar. So what we should have is a cost structure which bills registrars and registries first by some first in a way which depends on the work which is done for them. I would expect this to be maybe constant, maybe something else which grows slowly is the number of registrations, and I would expect that second we see something which is proportional to the number of registrants, and this could legitimately be described as the fee which is paid by registrants and thus by end users.
Okay.
For the moment.
Thank you for that. Thomas, what are you next in queue?
I wanted to make a couple of comments on points that had been raised earlier. First, in terms of the pure mathematics, it is important to understand that under the present kind of ICANN budgetary circumstances, any increase in ICANN's budget is borne by the GTLD registries and registrars, not by all contributors, because roughly 50% of the theoretical revenue stream coming into ICANN is not there. So that any increase in ICANN's budget is if it's going to be realized, if they're actually going to realize the increase in spending, if you think of the GTLV registries and registrars as funding about 50%, and the numbering registries and the CCTLV funding about 50%, every increase of ICANN spending results in twice as much impact on the GTLV's side because of the non-payment under the current circumstances of the other side. I want to agree, by the way, with Elizabeth's point before that is a contract issue between the parties, but the math of it is increases are borne disproportionately by the GTLVs because they actually pay. The second point I wanted to make is that, and it's again, I think another kind of a mathematical point. Jay Scott raised what I think is an important sort of philosophical point here, and that is sort of where does the money come from and how is the money allocated? I think it is important from the registry's constituency point of view to respond to his description, and that is, like any other business, a registry or, for that matter, a registrar has an investment, an operating expense, and a revenue stream, and obviously from that comes your income or your bottom line. Registries and registrars view their payments to ICANN as part of their operating expenses, and in fact that's exactly what it is. If you were to use an analogy, if I were a newspaper publisher, I would have revenue coming in from a buyer of my newspaper, and I would have a variety of expenses, one of which might be for an industry standards body that would be the counterpart of ICANN. Or even if you were to think of ICANN as a government, which it most definitely is not, but even if you were to think of ICANN as a government, one of my expenses might be the taxes that I pay to the local or national government. No matter how you look at it, the fact of the matter is that ICANN payments are an expense on the part of registries and registrars, and no more could you describe the newspaper publisher as a custodian of the money paid by the buyer of a newspaper than you could describe the registrar or registry as a custodian of the money paid by registrants. Registrants pay a fee for services that they are provided by registries and registries and registrars have operating expenses. The last point I want to make is to agree with someone who made the point before, and that is it is very important to recognize in all these discussions that whereas governments have the ability to impose taxes that are passed on to end users without raising antitrust issues, non-governmental organizations or industry associations or standards bodies really don't have that ability, so that the reality is that the situation in which ICANN is effectively what it describes itself as being, and that is a coordination body, a non-governmental coordination body among the industry, is not going to change any time that I could see in the foreseeable future. So that the fact is, ICANN's budget will continue to be borne as an operating expense by registries, registrars, and other payers into ICANN. Last point I want to just reiterate is that very little discussion ever takes place whenever we talk about the ICANN budget in what I described at the beginning as this sort of other category, which is non-dues payments, but all sorts of other areas or ways in which funds could be raised, and I think it's worth keeping that in mind as well. Thanks.
Okay, Roger, thank you for that. Time is moving on, so we ought to bring...
Peter, I'd just like to get in one comment.
Discussion on this to a close shortly. Was that Peter and Elizabeth I heard also?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I have Marilyn in queue existing. Perhaps we can make these the last three comments, and then we may move on to a second topic. Marilyn, go ahead.
I just want to indicate, Philip, that what I wanted to comment about, I'm sure I'm coming in late, was not this specific topic, but the draft version 2, 2 points. So if you put it in wherever. Sorry I'm late, but I need to get that in.
Oh, okay. Fine. Thank you, Peter. I'll take that at the end then. Marilyn, okay. First.
My point is about... I listened to these discussions on the part of folks and understand really how much we all look at these things from our own individual perspective and know that we really are all seeking to get above that and think about it in terms of the stability of the Internet and the common good, but we're all always driven by our own imperatives. But I want to suggest something. I think that, in fact, there are models in industry self-governance in existence today, not just standard bodies, but self-governance models in advertising, in ADR, and elsewhere, where there are fee models in place. And they are fee models, they're not tax models, and it's acknowledged by the industry and by the participants and by the individuals that they're fee models. So I really urge all of us to make an effort not to use the word tax. It isn't a tax. Everyone who says government's tax and private sector groups don't is quite right. Any discussion is about a user fee, not a tax. And I think we ought to see if we could look between now and our next call, see if there are any self-governance models in advertising, again, I would suggest, in ADR, where the mechanism of funding of the central entity, which does act as a self-governor, and by the way, kicks people out, at least the BBD in the U.S., both sanctions people who don't live up to their promises, and also does other interesting things to them, like refer them to the FTC, etc., all on the nature of contractual agreements. And people do pay fees to belong to that. So what I'll do is offer to sit down with the Better Business Bureau in the U.S. and learn a little bit more about their funding model, and suggest maybe somebody could look at the advertising and self-governance model in the UK or in Europe.
Okay, Marie, that's an excellent suggestion. Elizabeth.
Thank you, Philip. I very much agree with previous speakers telling us that funding of ICANN is a matter of contractual relationship, and it is extremely true in the case of CCTLD. We simply don't have contracts. We there's probably just two of them arriving, and there is 240, and nothing were done on that matter specifically by ICANN. And so the matter of contract is certainly very important. Another point is, Roger said that any increase of budget would be twice as would have twice as much impact on GTLD as on CCTLD. I don't agree, because until today CCTLD has been funding ICANN for really nothing. There is no, with the only exception of CCTLD liaison, there is no ICANN staff taking care about CCTLD. And from our perspective, the major activity is related to GTLD. So we cannot just have this simple mathematical look, even if it is very easy to say so.
Okay, Elizabeth, thanks. Peter, I'm conscious you want to speak in a moment. We're just going to finish off on this topic, and I'll come to that. In terms of conclusions, where are we? Are we mostly all saying that, without going into the mechanism in terms of how the money flows, that money that is in the registry system that is mostly derived from GTLDs is the way that we see most of ICANN's functions should be financed? Is that a safe assumption for what we're all saying?
I would second that.
This is Carrick. Is there any alternative? I mean, we've been talking about this, and it seems that there money is needed. There is only one way that money is generated in the TLD biz. So, is anybody prepared even to suggest an alternative?
Get Bill Gates to give us $5 trillion. That's about the only other.
That goes back to Roger's third sources point, which is.
And what I find, and I want to address just one comment to that is, I think that's a good idea, but what I have found in discussions with people about that particular idea is you're going to get very directed gifts. You're never going to get a gift that can go into a general budget. Somebody may give you money for security issues. Somebody may give you money for certain technical solutions, but it's very difficult to get gifts from foundations that just fund the day-to-day operations. They may fund special projects, but I don't know if it's realistic to look at special funding for overall budgeting considerations.
But can I just quickly respond and say that I did not have any specific model or source of funds in mind when I just said this sort of other category.
Okay.
But I do think it's important to note that the subject was first raised not by me, but rather by Stuart Lynn.
Yep.
Stuart's proposal was that ICANN have about an $18 million budget, $10 million of which come from governments. So his concept was that a majority of the ICANN budget would come from this new category of non-dues payments, which would be government contributions. So whether that fits or not, who knows? I'm just saying that we don't spend any time talking about that other category, and it's enormously important. Or whether
okay.
It could be anywhere from a charity ball to government donations to Bill Gates, I have no idea.
Well, I might address just that government point in a second. I just want to see where broadly we're. So if we're happy with that first broad conclusion in terms of the majority funding of ICANN, I would also suggest that I might try to capture in conclusions the point made earlier in terms of the way that budgeting should be based on certainty, and also budgeting by function would help that. Is that something that is also broadly supported?
Philip, before you go there, would you restate the majority funding should come from where?
What I was saying before is it within the registry system, the majority of funding, and for the GTLDs only, should be the source of the majority of funds for ICANN.
Okay. I'm happy with that. I just wanted to be sure I understood the exact formulation.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'll find some more elegant phrasing when I put pen to paper, but that's...
I think, Philip, that perhaps we need to also put in that statement that ICANN needs to look for ways to defray some of its expenses, i.e., conference attendance fees.
Yep.
That was brought along early on to help defray expenses that then would leave more money in the general budget.
Okay, and looking for alternatives, as we mentioned. So on the second point, we're happy also with this idea of sound budgeting based on certainty and ideally by function, which follows on from our conclusions of the last call.
My only problem with that comes down to the fact that then we get into, it becomes a debate about, well, then who is that money really from? Because if I was a registrar and I paid you $37 million and you say that it should be driven by function, then the registrar is going to say, well, then all $37 million has to be spent on only those functions that affect registrars.
And yeah, I think that's
okay.
Bruce Thompson, if I can comment on that.
Yeah, I do also want to indicate that I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with the language Philip just articulated a moment ago.
Okay, well then we may need a point, actually, because I think what Jay Scott, I think, was raising an important point in terms of how that may be made. Let's put it aside for a moment, because I think there's another point raised which we possibly may be able to dispatch relatively quickly, which is our views on government funding, which we haven't talked about so far. My understanding is that although this idea was raised by Stuart, the majority of members of the GAC and others that we've spoken to seem to be fairly negative to this, for a whole host of reasons to do with legitimacy, the ability to get the money, how that would actually happen, let alone the time it might take. My conclusion from that is that it may be unlikely to happen anyway. But would it be safe, do you think, for the Names Council to say something to the effect that government funding substantial revenues from governments should not be part of the ICANN model? That sets aside possibilities of GAC paying to attend a conference. Or does somebody believe different to that?
Well, I think that from the VC perspective, the point of view we've taken is that the GAC could contribute to defraying costs that they actually create, such as paying to attend a conference or secretariat costs, but not contributing to the core budget. We're not asking governments, and the BC in particular has said we do not believe governments should contribute to ICANN's overall budgeting.
Right. Does everybody agree with that as stated by now? Do people feel that should be different?
If I could just make a comment, this is Bruce Tonkin.
Bruce, go ahead.
It hasn't specifically been discussed within the registrars, but I'll really make a personal comment. My personal comment is that the problems that we've had by not having contractual relationships with CCTDs and RIRs is actually going to get even worse with governments. And so if ICANN thinks it can actually just state a budget, say, okay, our budget for governments is, you know, $10 million, and then expected governments to pay, they'll be at it for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
So therefore, I strongly agree with, as a personal level, with Marilyn's comment, and I don't, you know, I think the registrars haven't even discussed it because I just view it as just not being practical.
Right.
At another level, to talk about who pays, the people that pay ICANN are those that have the contractual relationship with ICANN in terms of the bulk of the fees, which are registries and registrars. Now, to draw the bow that means that because registrars are paying, that means that ICANN will only do things that you know, have something to do with a registrar, I think is drawing a long straw, because really, registrars, their customers are registrants. And a lot of the issues of consumer protection, security, intellectual property are all tied up with those customers. And at no stage have registrars said that we don't believe that those people should have a say in the ICANN process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. And
okay, so what you're saying, Bruce, is that maybe there was a difference between dividing up your functions and budgeting for those functions and the withholding of funds for those functions, which is the point Jay Scott was making, I think. There's a separation there, isn't there? Bruce?
I'm not quite sure about the point you're making, but I guess the point I would be making is that we're...
What I'm saying is, although we may want to have an ICANN which has clearly delineated functions, no one is suggesting at this point that whoever the funders are will be able to cherry-pick those functions and leave others high and dry.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, that's fine. That's the point I thought we were making, which I think was a point of agreement. Okay, any other comments on government funding? Does anybody think it's a great idea? No, I hear silence. That's most encouraging from a mostly private sector call. Other points we should make on funding, or shall we spend the next half hour in starting to talk about advisory bodies? Then let's move on to advisory bodies. And perhaps a sort of fundamental question in terms of I think one of the big differences I saw in some of the LIM proposals to where we are now is the breaking of the link between the we now call constituencies electing representatives to the councils of the supporting organization, those advisory bodies, and participating in a certain amount of board elections. So there was a direct linkage between participation and providing advice and being part of board. And in the new system, that linkage is broken in two ways by suggesting that there may be more things called forums that are talking shops and or advisory bodies without votes, and that there's a thing called a nominating committee, which will put people in place in terms of the what we now call councils. So on that point, are the comments in terms of the benefits and different disadvantages of either system?
Could I suggest that maybe I know Alex is on. Is Thomas on as well?
Both of them were on. Thomas is currently muted. Thomas has just come back on. Thomas, do you want
Thomas is now unmuted.
I was just wondering if maybe Thomas could talk a bit about that concept, because you and Alex are trying very hard to organize and improve the contributions of the GA, and you might have some thoughts about this.
Well, I believe that we should at least address. We should look at advisory bodies in terms of the functions they should fulfill, or in terms of the functions which are currently fulfilled by the SOs, and as Philip put it, we have the councils and we have the election of board members. I would like to put it a little bit different, because the questions we are addressing are, first, how are board members elected, and second, how is policy generated, because that's what the councils are actually intended for.
Yes, let's limit this discussion now just to the second part, Thomas, on policy. That was my intent.
Precisely. And quite frankly, although I know that I will be grilled by some on the GA for saying this, the task force process is in part working well. In other parts, it is not working too well. And I believe that one of the things we should focus on, regardless of what kind of council we may suggest or may not suggest, is how could policy development work in a reasonable way. And one suggestion I'd like to make is that we really start out from the current task force process and modify it. So what we should keep is that we have different constituencies and groups which determine, in whatever way, representatives to work on policy. This work on policy should not be coordinated by a member of any such constituency, but by independent and highly professional staff. Such staff should take the present function of the chair of such a task force. This way we avoid any conflicts of interest or allegations of such conflicts of interest, which everyone here, I suppose, has seen in the past. Also, this staff should produce written reports, which should include opinions raised until a certain point of time. By imposing strict deadlines, we avoid that any constituency can try to win by procrastinating things, which may be the case in the current mechanism. If we go for professional staff, which is neutral with respect to constituencies, and which has timelines, any constituency which procrastinates things basically ends up not being heard. The result would possibly be reports which could document consensus when it is there, or which would document dissensus if there just no consensus can be found. This would be, I believe, quite workable. Of course, there is one interesting question, that who are the constituencies and how are they to be determined? And I believe that any mechanism we may come up with, should be coupled to a review system for such policies. This review system would have to make sure that, first of all relevant constituencies have been taken into account, even if they are not part of the current structure, and it should also make sure that if some group which is self-organized if there's some self-organized group which regularly pops up and legitimately says, we haven't been heard, please include us with this process, that such groups be added as, constant constituents, real constituencies which always participate in the policy development process. Also, another suggestion I would like to raise is that such a policy development process should be handled in a flexible way, which may also take into account groups or constituencies from the very beginning of the process which are normally not participating. This could be some kind of special interest groups, for instance.
I think
you get the point.
So Thomas, what you're recommending there is an improved means of policy development,
yes,
within the existing SO structure.
It doesn't have to be within the existing SO structure.
Okay, are you advocating or the existing SO structure and the linkages within it? The point I'm trying to find.
I'm not at this point advocating either for or against it.
Okay, but this is a mechanism
really
that could be applied to one or the other.
How policy development process as it is currently handled can be improved.
Okay, I think that's important. I think one fundamental question, I think, is to my mind the difference between the process we have today, which is essentially a binding bottom-up consensus process, to the LIM model, which is advisory consultation only. So I'd be interested in hearing Names Council members' views on that question.
Let's make
a list. We have Marilyn, Thomas to come back.
Peter.
Again. Right, I've only heard Marilyn and Thomas. There was disturbance.
Sorry, can you just frame the discussion again? What are you asking for input on?
Peter. And
okay. Peter, I've heard. I'll put on. The question is, what is the Names Council's view of the difference between where we are today with a bottom-up binding consensus process to the model tomorrow that Lynn is proposing, which is these new bodies are advisory only with consultation, but the binding implication on the board no longer exists. So I have Marilyn, Thomas, and Peter in queue. Jay Scott.
Bruce, Tom, can you put in the queue?
Jay Scott and Bruce. Other names? Then Marilyn, start off.
I would really like to, I think, support a good deal of what Thomas just said about the need to start with improving the existing policy development process, regardless of what mechanism it takes place under, by adding professional staff. I don't know if I would go so far as to make them the chair, but I would note that in professional associations and organizations, it is the staff role to provide the gathering of information and the chair role to do more of the consensus building, outreach, making sure that all voices are heard, et cetera. Drafting is typically done by the chair, by the staff, et cetera. So I'm largely in support of much of what Thomas just said. I also would note, though, that in saying that I believe that the bottom-up policy process needs to remain
significantly, I don't know if I'm going to say exactly binding, but it needs to remain the priority and primary way that policy is agreed to, rather than moving the forums, whatever they are, or the advisory groups, whatever they are, into advisory only. So my suggestion is significant improvements can be made in the existing process by adding structure and changing some function, but I don't, at this point, see the need to change the process to advisory only.
Okay, thank you for that, Marilyn. Thomas?
Well, I would also like to elaborate on the point of advisory versus binding consensus process. The mechanisms I've been describing, when I was thinking about them, this was certainly with not the status quo, but the status which should be in mind, namely that we have a binding consensus process, or almost binding, maybe. Don't know about this detail, but it should be.
Okay. Well, I think
or if for a binding policy development process, which should not just be taken as advisory. If you are just giving advice, you don't need to look for inclusiveness, for instance, in such a great deal as I've been doing it. I believe this is important to keep in mind, and I'd also advocate that we go for a policy development which happens bottom-up and which includes, as David Johnson so puts it so nicely, the consensus of those who are governed.
Yep, indeed. Okay, thank you for that. I'm almost binding is perhaps quite a good description of where we are today anyway, actually. Peter, you're next on the list.
First of all, I'm kind of doing a lot of this under protest, but just to keep a comment to this specific subject area, you mentioned that what we have today, the binding bottom-up consensus building, as opposed to what we would be going into in the Stewart model, which is really an advisory and a top-down. Well, I believe that I have experienced that what we have today is, in fact, a top-down. I've seen situations in my term on the Names Council where we go through very elaborate, and I just cite a recent one with Milton's .org deal. I mean, I don't always agree with Milton's constituency, but the fact is, as far as the work that was done, an enormous amount of work was done by Milton and everybody who worked in there, putting time and developing, you know, a very studious, he's a college professor, very well worked out consensus, which was basically ignored. And this has been the situation in the past. If in fact we were getting the bottom up, it would be great, but we're not getting it. So what I see happening here is the possibility of looking for the Names Council to, if we come back with an okay on this, or if we come back and say we go along with this, we are in fact endorsing what is already happening. This is not a change. If what was happening was the binding bottom up, I would be all for that. And that's
okay. I think it's quite a good observation, Jay Scott.
I hate to disagree, but I believe that unless we have a board that has power, now it may need to be a supermajority power, to act on its own, then we're just kidding ourselves, because they are going to do it. And they have to be able to do it. I've never been in any organization where the board is not going to do that. So what we can either do is realize what Peter has just discussed is where we sit today and find mechanisms to perhaps make it more difficult or for the board to act on its own or to change or tweak recommendation from the bottoms-up process. There has to be a two-thirds majority of the board to vote. But I think we're kidding ourselves and would be just putting into effect another illusory model unless we realize the actual fact that a board has to have the power to act on its own in certain situations. So that's where I come to Thomas's point, where we have an almost binding system, but I don't think we're ever going to be able to get a board that's going to be just a rubber stamp. That's just not the way it's going to go, whether it's in written in our bylaws or not. I think we certainly would clean up a lot of the process if we acknowledged the reality and we got our bylaws into shape such that that reality was reflected, so that we would end a lot of the argument on process when the reality takes hold and the board does act on its own.
Yes, no, thank you for that. Bruce, you're next on the line.
I guess I'd probably then disagree a bit with the last speaker there. I guess my issue is that the board should primarily be an oversight role to see that proper process has been applied, but that it shouldn't be trying to create policy within the board itself. Once you start doing that, then it becomes incredibly critical who you elect onto the board, and pretty much everything else becomes irrelevant. And that's part of the problem we've got now. Everyone's so focused on getting people voted onto the board because, as Peter pointed out, a lot of the decisions are being made in a top-down fashion. But to pick up on some of Thomas's things, the reason why the board's actually having to do that is because the bottom-up process is not working. It's too slow, and that partly comes down to perhaps a better definition of what appropriate process is, and that might be somewhere where the board could help a lot, is actually defining what is the process that a particular decision needs to go through. Now, that would depend on whether it's a major decision or a minor decision. A minor decision might be to decide whether the waiting period of a delete should be 30 days or 31 days. You know, if it's something like that, I don't think it needs to go through a six-month process development. Something like .org I think is significant, and I think it deserved the attention that it got. And I'd also agree that the board should have accepted the .org report in its total, and if it disagrees with that, then it should then seek further process, perhaps a further public comment period or something, on the implication that they think we haven't gone through the appropriate process there. I think you need to separate the board's function is to identify whether appropriate process has been done in developing a particular policy, and then we need to work out ways to improve the processes we use to develop the policy.
Okay, I think that's a good distinction.
Would you put me in the queue, Ken Stubbs, please?
Ken, you're putting it in a second. I'm just trying to think through some conclusions here. I haven't heard any voices yet who are saying they think that the Stewart model of advisory only is a very good one. So at the moment, the assumption is the council believes broadly that the existing model is right, and we've heard ways in which we can improve that to make it more effective. And some endorsement of the suggestion that task forces, or whatever we call them, that have dedicated staff support to make them effective and to push them along, etc., with timelines, would be a good way forward. Ken.
Well, I guess, first of all, let me take what you just said there, and let's try to elaborate it a little bit. Your comment, and correct me if I'm not paraphrasing you correctly, is that you said there has been some endorsement of support for the idea that there should be staff support. And I think what we need to do is, regardless of the nature of the committee, whether they be advisory or more open, Can't we get a consensus from the council that there is a strong need for staff support for this function, rather than just a reading or something like that? And I'm not really calling for the question, but is there anybody on this call who feels that there shouldn't be a more formal support structure for any advisory body, whether it be advisory in capacity only or a task force?
Okay, I think it's a good way of phrasing the question. To some extent, the DNSS has already answered that, because we voted some time back to ask for additional support. We're perhaps thinking now for something that would need to be greater than that. But does anybody want to answer Ken's question? Disagree with the idea that there should always be
dedicated staff support to the advisory bodies of ICANN, whatever they end up looking like.
Well, I'd rather use the policy-forming bodies rather than advisory bodies.
The policy-forming bodies, yeah.
I think a lot of the problems that we've had, even the problem, let's say the problem with .org, if there's something coordinating between the board and the advisory body, as Bruce calls it, we wouldn't run into a circumstance where there wouldn't be enough of a time gap between the requested input and response for the opportunity for additional interaction. And I think that's part of the problem right now. You know, the board has to act on something, and if it doesn't like what it sees, the time parameters are so compressed it can't even go back to the advisory body and ask for additional input based on their response.
The don't like shouldn't be based on the don't like it because they disagree with the opinion. The don't like should be they think that the process to develop that opinion was wrong.
Okay, I have some other voices that want to speak. Names, please.
Tony.
Tony, anybody else? No, Tony, go ahead.
I was just going to make part of the point that Ken made in advance. If you look at the .org situation, I think that the time gap in there wouldn't have been there, and certainly if there'd been a linkage with some support between the task force and the board, I think the board would have been compelled to have viewed that somewhat differently, and at least there would have been some follow-on dialogue taking place that would have got us out of that situation. So there's a clear example of something that could have been fixed if we'd had a different process in place. The other point I'd like to make is that the one advisory group we've had so far is the GAC, and I've heard numerous times people from within the GAC stand up and state quite openly that having the GAC as an advisory body is fine, providing ICANN takes notice of what they advise them and actually acts on it. And what's being promoted in the new proposals is something where quite clearly that wouldn't happen in every case. In fact, I would suggest it wouldn't happen in many cases. And we have an example of one advisory body that sets out a clear example of how things don't work if you don't listen.
Sure. Okay, let me just ask one other question in our remaining minutes. In the past, the Names Council has endorsed the desire of the CCTLD constituency to form its own supporting organisation. We've seen in the Lynn proposals the concept indeed of a separation of a body for the CCTLDs. The exact makeup may be different to that envisaged by other parties. But is it also a safe assumption to say that we do broadly favour a separate CCTLD organisation in whatever new construct of ICANN we have? Is that still a safe assumption? And if you disagree with that, maybe the voices to hear.
Well, I'd certainly like to speak to that, Peter.
Peter, go ahead.
I've been certainly encouraged by the idea that the Names Council would support the idea that the BCC, CCTLD has some kind of organization to...
I think we've done that before.
...to deal with, with the ICANN. I think this would be a good time for me to make the comment. Again, I'm sorry, I missed the first hour. I only got the corrected time recently. But this whole terms of reference with the draft version 2, whatever, of the scope and mission, there's just a couple of things in there that the interests of moving forward, figuring that we're taking parallel tasks. The CCTLD administrative functions, such as requests for delegation and redelegation.
I might have to stop you there. You may have missed seeing version 4 of that. Elizabeth has already made a change to that description, which is, what's in brackets, has now changed to such as updating IANA database entries concerning CCTLD managers or request for delegation and re-delegation.
All right, I'll hold that off.
If you're happy with that or wanted to make a clarification or by email, by all means do. It's only
right.
supposed to be...
I'll hold that off pending seeing form, number 4. The other thing was that, and this may be addressed in her document, but policy making, including CCTLD global policy coordination, I have a problem with... basically, the policy only for legacy GTLD and new GTLDs and registrar schemes under contract. I would have a problem with throwing in making policy for the CCTLD, because in 5.2 it says policy coordination, but in the overall title it says making policy. So I don't know if that was addressed in 4, but I'm looking for ways that the CC can support this exercise by the NC.
Okay, what may help, but all I was trying to capture in that list was a précis of what's already in the LIN notes, so it's saying nothing more than is currently happening.
Okay.
If you've got better phrasing for 5.2 to make that clearer, by all means email that to me and I'll use it.
Okay, fine. And I support what you just said about the NC looking to the CC having an organization to deal with it.
Carrie would like to speak, Philip.
Carrie, go ahead.
Okay. I wonder if we're not tripping a little bit over our own feet or procedures, as it might be. And if we are going to discuss a restructure of an organization, I don't think we should intermingle tidbits that would be taken from the old organization with a non-preconceived review of what an alternative might be. So although any number of things that have been said thus far in the conversation are extraordinarily reasonable, indeed might be worthy of our support, shouldn't we be talking at this point about, literally from the top down at this point, there's ICANN, and then how might the next support layer look, and how might the next support layer below that look, rather than take bits and pieces which kind of lock us into a legacy system?
No, I support that, because again, Stuart is asking us to use his proposal as a basis to indicate what we would want would be different. That very premise is what you're speaking against, and I agree with that. We should have our own premise.
Well, actually, it's not. I mean, I'm speaking on the basis of Stuart's proposal. What I'm suggesting is that the level on which we question that proposal ought to be set by us, rather than any tidbits of the way things are being done that we regard as being done right.
Absolutely. Sorry, Philip, didn't mean to joke.
That's fine. I mean, that's Carrie, what you're arguing for was a slight change of the way we address these 6 issues which I've laid out, and you may be talking about the board composition and participation issue first, which indeed we'll have to be doing next, but next will have to be another time, I think.
I think another time, because I think, as others have pointed out, we're just picking one particular issue and trying to make a decision on it.
Yeah.
I think it's too early to jump there.
Unless anybody wants to carry on for much longer, my feeling is we may have sort of exhausted the main points for today. I will again attempt to draw some conclusions, and we'll also have some minutes of this, and then we can all comment on those, and they'll be added to what we had before, which would mean that our next call we'd move on, I think, to address that broader topic that Carrie has just indicated in terms of the way we'd like to see everything, starting with board composition and down to how participation happens in that, and in particular in terms of the makeup of the board, and to my mind the big question of this concept of nomination committees, and if there is a 100% or partial role for such. But let me just leave those questions with you to think on. Are there other suggestions in terms of the way we move forward on our next call, or anything related to that before we close?
This is Thomas. Thomas.
You? Yeah, anybody else who wants to make some closing comments? No? Then Thomas, go ahead.
I believe that it is not reasonable to start to discuss details of board composition before we are clear on how we want the policy development bodies or whatever look like. In particular, while we have been talking a little bit about policy development today, we have not covered whether or not policy development bodies should be the same bodies which send to the board, whether it should be what should make binding decisions and so on, should be bound in its decisions to policy development from the bottom up and so on, and all these factors will have to influence any results we come up with respect to board composition. So I would believe that we should try first get an overall picture. What structure, in very, very, very general terms, do we expect to be proposing? And then we should try to work out the details. We should not start with the board. We should start by a very general structure. We want a board. we want this board to perform the following functions within the structure. We want or we do not want policy development or advisory bodies below it. We want this or that structure for constituencies. We should try to get this clear in very abstract terms and then try to fill in the details such as board selection.
Okay, I thought in terms of the policy bits that we deal with, we had tackled some of that, Thomas, just over the last 2 hours, with a feeling that the sort of advisory body that we have, policy advisory body we have at the moment, is about right, and we might want to reform that to make it more effective.
I wasn't sure if you had consensus on that. If you have it, then this part of the puzzle is, of course, there.
Well, I had asked for those voices who wanted an alternative or were in favor of the Lynn model, and we didn't hear comments on that. So that's the working assumption for the moment. And on some of the greater detail, indeed, that may be something to fill in later. An email will be a very good opportunity to do that if people have got specific models of reform in mind.
Actually, Philip, could you possibly in your minutes or not in the minutes, in the summary or whatever we call it of this call, try to include a very rough blueprint, just high level, of what structure we are envisioning, so we can possibly have some consensus on this by the next call and go that way. I think it may be helpful to have this.
If everybody's happy with that, I'm happy to make that attempt without being too definitive.
That would be great. Just that we have the components together and...
Okay, any other closing comments before we break? The next call is scheduled for 2 weeks from where we are today. Now, there may be some other names council business that we need to deal with there. I would like, if possible, to do as much of that by email as possible. So if members have issues they want to raise, please don't wait for physical meetings, but let's try to do that by email in between. And then if issues come out of that email exchange that we need to spend some time discussing, then we can do that next call as well. And if we need to schedule it to extend perhaps a bit longer than usual, we may do so if that looks necessary. But let's judge that by the demands we see, as we don't want to lose sight of our existing agenda as well as this rather special one. And I would again strongly endorse those who have particular model suggestions to make to mail the list so we can see that thinking. Any work in progress in your constituencies would be useful to see as well. Please mark it as such, but then we can get a feeling for that thinking, because the timeline is very short. And I think the more ideas that we have that we can perhaps grab a few broad ideas from is going to be more successful. Otherwise, we will be out of time to influence the process in the way we may like.
Philip, I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
I volunteered to see what BBB is doing, but someone from Europe who has access to some of the self-governance models there, are there other people who could also...
I'm happy to try that. I'll ask some people to see if we can try something. Yeah.
That'd be great.
So, with that that thought, then, I thank you very much for your participation today, and we will talk again in a fortnight.
Okay, thank you all.
Bye-bye. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much.